Let me tell you what my deep research and basically vision is.
I hope there's Bigfoot. I don't think there is.
I'm not telling you nothing.
the aliens won't let it happen.
Happening now, breaking.
Bernie Sanders is
Bears beats Battlestar Galactica.
What are the tips? Give me some tips on how to work with Wes Anderson.
Be ready to speak very fast and very clearly, because that's definitely one key thing.
I will only tell the truth. I will only
until you and six kids you barely know in wet bathing suits have surrounded nine chimpanzees outside of a Wendy's. You probably really don't know yourself, okay?
Yep. And we back.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to your new favorite podcast and the best in political, sports, and paranormal news coverage. I'm your host, Wes Anderson, and this is In the Shed. This is episode 001, so congratulations to each and every one of you for getting in on this thing from the ground floor up. I'm recording this podcast from my shed in the backyard of my home in Alabama, so I'm pretty much living the dream. Each week, I'll invite you into the shed along with me, and together we'll take a lighthearted but honest look at the previous week's most important and interesting headlines and stories. Now, before you label me a loser, because I'm sitting alone in a shed in the middle of the night, recording the very first episode of a podcast that very few people will ever actually listen to, I'll have you know for the record, I drive a 2017 Chevy Silverado. I make a mid-level income with health insurance. And I happen to have married the girl of my dreams, so I'm a pretty big success. 31 years old and finally firing on all cylinders at last. On a serious note, I've always wanted to do a podcast. After all the cool kids are doing it. And if you want to spring for a USB mic, a pair of studio headphones, a pop filter, and in my case, an incredibly long extension cord, then you too can have something in common with Michelle Obama, Macaulay Culkin, and the ever-handsome Freddie Prinze Jr. I love to learn, I like to talk, and I have a wide variety of interests, so this should be fun. Also, if you happen to hear dogs barking, or police sirens, or cars driving by, just keep in mind that that's because I'm recording this podcast in a shed in my backyard in Alabama. Now, you may have noticed that in my intro I said that you're listening to the best news coverage of the political, sports, and paranormal variety. That's because In the Shed is a news show. But it's one that's unlike any other that I'm aware of, even beside the fact that it's being recorded in a shed, as each week we'll discuss the headlines, stories, and rumors in the political, sports, and paranormal world, three topics that I find to be interesting, that are fun, and that matter to listeners in our world today. I said that we're the best at it, because I can't imagine that there's too many other people doing what we'll be doing here. When we talk about politics on In the Shed, I want you to know our interest won't be in telling you what to think or in stoking the fires of outrage. We don't do that here. Instead, our focus will remain on giving you something to think about, as well as laying out a roadmap for you of what's being said on the left, on the right, and from the center, and we'll let you discern for yourself what it all means. I'm sure I'll throw my 2 cents in here or there. I am the one in the shed, after all. But mostly, I just hope to inform you. I'm not anyone special. I have no distinguishing qualifications, no revolutionary insights. I'm just a guy with a microphone in a shed. But one thing I can do is I can get you the information you may not be aware of otherwise and let you decide what it means. I think that's one of the biggest failures of our media today, whether you're watching OAN, Fox News, CNN, or MSNBC, is that none of them seem to trust their viewers or smart enough to figure out what to think for themselves. None simply report the news and let you decide what to do with it. Not anymore. Instead, they tell you what to think. And they all do. They all do it. They sell their brand. They push their political agenda as hard as they can. They create echo chambers and they make sure to lay out for you exactly what you should think and why. What you should be angry about. What you should celebrate. What you should protest. On In the Shed, we're different. I'm a simple man. I don't assume that I'm smarter than you. So each week when we cover politics, I'll highlight a few stories of importance or of interest. I'll give them to you from all sides, and I'll trust that you're smart enough and principled enough to decide what it means for yourself. In addition to informing you and sharing with you a wide screenshot of what's being said from all sides of the political spectrum, we're also here to entertain. On In the Shed, we'll cover serious developments in the political world, no doubt, but we'll also bring some much-needed levity to the news. Some lightheartedness, some humor. In our country, we tend to take ourselves far too seriously, and in our political atmosphere right now, that's rife with divisiveness and angst, for the good of all, we'll refuse to do that. We'll refuse to take ourselves too seriously. In addition to the serious stuff, we'll share with you some silly political news, some stories that make you go, huh, and the stories that just aren't getting the attention that they deserve. So when it comes to politics, we'll inform, we'll laugh together, we'll poke fun, we'll speak truth to power, and we'll draw attention to the stories that aren't getting enough attention. Our approach to sports on In the Shed will be similar in the sense that we'll talk about the headline news and developments in the world of sports, as well as the goofy, the bizarre, the nonsensical, but we'll do so without being bombastic or over the top or theatrical to a fault. If you enjoy that sort of thing, you can go watch Stephen A. or Skip Bayless. That's not me. We won't be doing that here. We'll talk about college football and basketball, the NFL, the NBA, maybe some MMA or boxing or golf on occasion. We won't spend time covering hockey or soccer because I don't find sports that end with a 3-1 score to be of any interest. And we won't talk about Major League Baseball much either because I have served my sentence as an Atlanta Braves fan for over a quarter century and I've decided that I am done. There's too much else in this world to be disappointed in. I just don't need it for my baseball team. When it comes to the paranormal, we'll cover all of our bases. We'll discuss everything from Bigfoot to aliens, angels, hauntings, miracles, monsters, legends, lore, conspiracy theories, and the unexplainable. Over the course of our time together, I'm sure I'll share some personal stories with you, and hopefully you with me. We'll have some laughs, we'll learn a bit together, and we'll remember what it feels like to be in awe. Now, I'll let you know from the offset, when I share these stories of paranormal phenomena with you, I'm not presenting each one of these stories as fact. I guess I'm a hopeful skeptic on a lot of this stuff. But I do think it's interesting and more important than we like to admit. I wasn't born yesterday by any means. I'm no Amelia Bedelia, if you remember those books. But I'm also not so arrogant that I outright dismiss what I don't understand. Paranormal simply means outside of normal scientific understanding. And by that definition, there's a lot that I do believe in that qualifies as paranormal. So whatever the topic, whether politics, sports, or paranormal things, I simply ask you to approach our conversations with an open mind, a good sense of humor, and a healthy amount of curiosity. Our goal here on In the Shed is to inform, to entertain, and to connect with our listeners. I have to take so much time here at the outset giving such an extended introduction, but with this being our first episode ever, I wanted to give you an idea of what to expect when tuning in each week. Now that that's out of the way, we can jump straight into the news on next week's show. So to you, the listener, if you're hearing this right now, I just want to say thank you. I appreciate you giving us a chance. If you like what you hear, awesome. If not, please give us another shot. It can only go up from here. I'm confident that this, our first episode, will get at least 7 listeners, I think. I figure I can count on my wife tuning in, as well as maybe one of my sisters, maybe one of my brother-in-laws. Hello, Matt. Or maybe you, Russell. Probably my mother. Definitely my meemaw. Any of you Southerners that have a meemaw, you know you can count on meemaw. Maybe my best friend, and I'm hoping that at least one of you hearing this found us randomly while scrolling your favorite podcast app and now have resolved to become a tool. Yes, that's right, a tool. That is what I have decided to refer to our listeners as since we're meeting in a shed. I figured that that was fair. So with that in mind, I'm going to set a forever goal today, right here, right now, on episode 001 in front of all 7 of you tools. It's my goal, Wes Anderson is host of In the Shed with Wes Anderson, to get to the point that eventually we have a total of 50 or more listeners for a single solitary episode of our show. That's my goal. Okay, before we move on, with this being our maiden voyage together, hopefully going a little bit better than the maiden voyage of, say, maybe the Titanic, here's a little bit about me. I'm 31 years old, and I live in Alabama. I really am in a shed in my backyard. I'm a husband and a father. I have 2 beautiful children. I have a son who's 8 months old and a daughter who's 4. And I'm a brother. I'm a middle child, a registered independent politically. I root for both the Auburn Tigers and the Kentucky Wildcats, and usually when I say that, people assume that what I mean is that I root for Auburn during football season and Kentucky during basketball season, but actually that's not the case. My mom grew up in Kentucky, so I've always been a Kentucky fan. I get the Auburn gene from my father, who introduced me to Auburn football and basketball as a child, so I actually follow both teams in both seasons. I'm also a Golden State Warriors and Atlanta Hawks fan. I'm a hip-hop historian, a hoops fanatic, and a low-key Bible scholar. I love to read and to write. I have an Australian Shepherd Husky mix rescue named Susan. No, I did not pick out that name. For me, it's PlayStation over Xbox, Coke, not Pepsi, Chevy, not Ford. I'm down with both the beach and the mountains, but never country music. All right, there, that should just about do it. That's me in a snapshot. I hope you feel good about that. I feel like we just went on our first date, except for I did all the talking. So now you have a pretty good idea of who I am, and I'm struggling to remember your first name. Has that ever happened to you before? I remember one time in college, a girl came to see me, and I think maybe she had a teeny bit of a crush on me. And, you know, I was a little bit interested in her as well. But it had been a while since we had seen each other. And when I went to introduce her to my roommates, I blanked on her name. I knew her, I knew who she was, but just completely blanked. And I could not think of it. And I just said, "And this is my friend." And as you can guess, that was the end of that. We never went on a date. Oh man, I hope she never hears this because she will know exactly who I'm talking about. But if you ever do hear this, I am so sorry. That was incredibly embarrassing. All right, moving on. Since this is our first ever episode, and it is still early in the year of our Lord 2021, before we hit the news, I wanted to do something fun. I thought that we would issue here on In the Shed with Wes Anderson 10 predictions for the year 2021. These are 10 things that I think are likely to happen this calendar year. So what I want to do is I want to make these predictions here on our first episode ever in front of you. And then on our last episode of the year, before we hit a new year, we'll pull these back out. We'll dust them off. We'll review them together and we'll see if I got any of them right. Are you ready for this? 10 predictions for 2021. Number one, things return to normal, sort of. I think with it being 2021, with a new administration coming in, with the vaccines becoming more readily available, I think that mostly over time during this year, things will return to normal. However, I don't expect that in this calendar year, things will completely go back to how they were pre-COVID. I think some of the things, unfortunately, that we have gotten used to and have become a new normal will hang around, such as possibly masks, maybe social distancing, some of the things working from home that we've become accustomed to. So I think things will return to normal mostly, but some of those things will stick around for the year too. Prediction number two. Betty White lives. I am predicting right here in front of everyone that the best thing to happen, even before sliced bread, I was about to say sliced bread, but I think Betty White is actually older than sliced bread, so I guess sliced bread is the best thing to happen since Betty White. But I'm predicting right here in front of all of you that Betty White makes it through the year 2021. She just had her 99th birthday. She's a national treasure. We all love her. And I want to see her live forever. So I'm predicting that she lives for the whole year 2021 and she makes it to be 100 years old. Prediction number three. If number two doesn't come back to haunt me, that would be great. So if you could hold on, Betty, I would appreciate it. Number three, we find life on another planet. I'm predicting this year in 2021 will be the year that we find out that life is out there. I'm not saying that there will be aliens that are more intelligent than us or that are comparable beings. But I think on some planet in some galaxy this year, we will receive confirmation that we have discovered some sort of life, even if it is microscopic. Number four, I predict that Tom Brady wins it all and retires. I know he has said on multiple occasions that he wants to play until he's like 50 or some crazy thing like that. And based on this year, maybe he could. But I also think that a large part of him going to the Buccaneers in the first place was that he wanted to prove he could win away from Bill Belichick, away from New England, that he could be the difference maker on a championship team without the system that comes with the Patriots. And I think that he does. I think this year that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are in a good position. I think their defense has outperformed expectations. He has all kinds of weapons on offense. I think they win it all. And then Tom Brady decides that he has a beautiful wife and millions of dollars and some children, and he rides off into the sunset and retires. Number five, Andrew Yang will be elected mayor of New York City. This is a prediction that would make the Yang gang incredibly happy. I think that Andrew Yang has already made his intention to run for mayor public. And I think that he wins. He got a lot of notoriety running for the Democratic nomination of president. And I think that he will pull it out and he will become the next mayor of the city that never sleeps. Prediction number six, a new Jaws movie will be announced. So you have probably noticed, as have I, that the in thing now are remakes. I'm not suggesting that they remake Jaws. There's already, four of them, I think. But instead, I'm predicting that they announce a new one, that they add another movie to the series, they come up with a new twist on it, and that a new Jaws movie will be announced this year. Prediction number seven, a Trump will run for office, but it will be Lara, wife of Eric. I think that's how she says her name, right? Lara Trump. She has flirted with the idea publicly of running for office. I don't know where, I don't know what office that will be, but I think that she runs for office this calendar year. Prediction number eight, the Lakers repeat as NBA champions. This is not something that would make me particularly happy, but I do think it's incredibly likely. LeBron James is not slowing down. Anthony Davis is a beast on the block. And this offseason, they got younger. They got deeper. They got more athletic. They added Dennis Schroeder at point guard, who is awesome. They added several other pieces. They added veterans like Marc Gasol. They're playing great so far. I think, unfortunately, the Lakers win it all again and go back to back. Prediction number nine, Bitcoin finishes the year below $20,000. So currently at time of recording this, Bitcoin is at $33,262.97. It has been going up and up and up lately. My brother-in-law Matthew gifted me with some Bitcoin a while back for Christmas. And at the time it was about $14 or so. I think it's maybe like 0.1% of a Bitcoin or something, or maybe it's 1%. I don't recall. Y'all can do the math for me. But now that Bitcoin that was worth $14 is worth $33. So I am swimming in the dough. Thank you, Matthew. But my prediction is it will kind of peter off and it will finish 2021 below $20,000. And prediction number 10, drumroll please, is that our podcast, In the Shed with Wes Anderson, will hit its goal of 50 listeners for a single episode this calendar year. So those are our 10 predictions for 2021. Like I said, the last episode that we do of the year, we'll pull this out, we'll dust it off, and we'll see how we did. I think it would be a huge success to get, even three of those right? I think that'd be pretty cool. So now let's go to the world of politics. Let's switch to this. Before we get into any specific stories, one thing that we're going to do here on In the Shed is we're going to hit the headlines. This is an opportunity for me to share some headlines with you just so you have an idea in your mind and you get a roadmap of the things that are being talked about, what's being said nationally. We'll cover far-right news sites. We'll cover middle-of-the-road places as well as left-leaning organizations. We'll just use this portion of the show to just call out some headlines to you, give you an idea of what's being said around the political spectrum. So here we go. Here are the headlines. Headline number one, the most popular president in U.S. history isn't doing so well on YouTube, says Alex Jones and InfoWars. Most popular president in U.S. history isn't doing so well on YouTube. Obviously talking about Joe Biden, as he got more votes than any presidential candidate in history. From the Epoch Times, UK Prime Minister, evidence suggests new CCP virus variant associated with higher death rate. From Fox News, GOP governors order National Guard home from DC over alleged mistreatment. I'm sure you heard about that. Yahoo News says they're criticizing Biden from the left. It's a little different headline there. CNN says some Republicans quietly lobbying to convict Trump. And from the Young Turks, they say prayer breakfast leaders backed Trump's election lies. Prayer breakfast leaders backed Trump's election lies. So there are the headlines for today. give you a quick snapshot and overview of what's being talked about on the web when it comes to the world of politics. Let's get to our first story. Some observations about the inauguration of the 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden. What does the R stand for anyway? Like, I don't know. Richard? Rodrigo? Reinhardt? No. I don't know. Joseph R. Biden. So if you know what the R is, you can send us an email and let me know. I don't feel like Googling it. Here are some observations from his inauguration. Joe Biden looked old, but he did a good job, right? So he did not look like he was a thriving individual necessarily. However, he did do a pretty good job. He held it together. He didn't stick his foot in his mouth. He gave a pretty good speech. It was not the greatest inaugural speech ever, like Chris Wallace said on Fox News, but I thought it was solid. He did a good job. He started from the right place, talking about healing, talking about unity. I know folks on the right say that that's a bunch of hogwash, where it was all this unity throughout the Trump presidency. But look, we are where we are, and the only place we can start from is good intentions. So I think you have to talk about unity. You have to talk about coming together, and then hopefully the actions will bear out that both sides are willing to do that. So I thought it was a good speech. Kamala Harris makes history. So she becomes the first ever African-American, the first ever Asian-American, the first ever woman vice president, all wrapped up in one person, which I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. The fact that we have someone in the White House serving as vice president who is a woman and who fits all those criteria is an exciting thing, especially for little girls who can look at the White House and see some representation. Anytime history is made in our political and elected offices, it's a cool thing. Also, how could you not notice George Bush and Michelle Obama, right? Like, this is the power couple that we didn't know we needed. George Bush and Michelle Obama are so cute. I mean, they really are. Like, they're best friends. They always find each other. You know, I don't know if George Bush is, like, giving her some peppermint candies or butterscotch, probably, right, because of his age. But they're really funny together. They always have a good time. That was really cool. And the coolest thing was that there was no violence. Maybe that was because there wouldn't have been any anyway. Maybe that was because after the Capitol and the incidents that happened on January the 6th, that people realized we needed to tamp things down. Very likely it was because there was 25,000 National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. in preparation, just in case. More troops in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, than we have in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan combined. So, but I was glad. I was glad that there was no violence. I think the news station said that there was maybe a couple hundred of protesters, some in support of Biden, some against Biden. That was a ways away from the inauguration, and it was peaceful. And I thought that that was a good thing, obviously. But the real story from the inauguration, the star of the inauguration, was Bernard Theophilus Sanders III. Is that his real name? No, I don't think Bernie Sanders has a middle name, actually. Fun fact right there, trivia. But the soon-to-be budget chairman broke the internet and solidified his place in the meme hall of fame next to the dog in the burning house. The crying Jordan memes and that kid who looks like he got caught sneaking a cookie or just witnessed something incredibly stupid happen. I'm sure you've seen the memes. Bernie Sanders was chilling, man. He was laid back. He was chilling. Giant jacket on. He had those handmade mittens rocking. He had his legs crossed. There's just the most hilarious memes that people have put together about his look at the inauguration. The three best, in my opinion, there was Bernie Sanders at the Last Supper. They sat him next to Jesus. That was pretty funny. Bernie Sanders as a member of the Wu-Tang Clan, and the one that had the inauguration just as a part of Bernie Sanders' regular everyday schedule. I think it was like 8:30 breakfast, 10 o'clock Joe's thing, 11:30 running by the post office. So Bernie Sanders kind of stole the show. The inauguration, for the most part, went off without a hitch, and I was glad to see that. Now, a lot of people have been talking about something else that has to do with the inauguration, and that's the fact that former President Donald Trump did not show up. He broke with tradition. He left the White House early, and he was not there. Now, I've heard a lot of speculation from all different places and all different sources on why President Trump, former President Trump, was not at Joe Biden's inauguration. But I want to let you know that here on In the Shed, we actually have an inside scoop. We actually know the real reason that Trump was not there. And there's actually five reasons that Donald Trump did not attend the inauguration. Would you like to hear them? This is completely legit. The five reasons that Donald Trump did not attend the inauguration. Number five, because the McRib is back. Yeah. He was, the McRib's back. He saw the signs. He, you know, get a little snacky snack. Number four, he didn't want to sit by Mike Pence. Number three, he heard that Eric was going, so he didn't go. Number two, he thought Garth Brooks was there to perform Friends in Low Places and was worried that everybody would stare. And the number one reason, the completely real, not made up reason, that Donald Trump did not attend the inauguration was because he didn't want to get stuck swapping Epstein stories with Bill Clinton again. So there you go. The five reasons that Donald Trump did not attend the inauguration. Next news story we want to talk about is Impeachment 2, the sequel. I read the CNN headline earlier implying that even some prominent Republicans are lobbying for President Trump to face conviction after being impeached for a record-breaking second time. Meanwhile, some on the left are calling not just for President Trump to be convicted of the charges brought against him during the second impeachment, but also to be held legally responsible for the actions of the violent mob that accosted the Capitol building on January the 6th. A few days ago, in fact, MSNBC had a host of legal experts on, taking turns dissecting and discussing the odds of President Trump being convicted of criminal charges now that he's out of office and sent to jail because of his rhetoric at the rally that directly preceded all the rioting. Now, I've heard a lot of conflicting stories about what was actually said at that rally, so I thought we would lay out some facts for you. So what did Trump actually say? Did he talk about peaceful protest? Yes. Did he say that you've got to fight like hell? Yes. Did he, during the rioting, release a video in which he called those who were in the Capitol and those protesting outside very special people and say, "We love you"? Yes. Did Alabama State Representative Mo Brooks say, and I quote, "It's time to kick and take names"? Yes. Did America's mayor and Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani at that rally say that we needed, as patriots, to engage in trial by combat? Yes, he did. We encourage you here on In the Shed to go watch the video for yourself. Not just to listen to what we have to say or what any news organization has to say. Check out the video, but those are the facts as we know them. Now, many on the right point to Democratic politicians like Maxine Waters and Cory Booker and Ayanna Pressley, who at different times have made statements about getting in the face of Republican politicians, letting them know your displeasure, calling them out when you see them in public, that sort of thing. That's not quite the same. It's not quite the same as standing in front of thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are already angry, who are already upset, getting them more fired up and then sending them to the Capitol where the vote that they're fired up about is about to be certified. It's just not the same thing. It's comparing apples and oranges. It is different, but it's not right either. And both highlight a massive problem within our politics today as we see it, and that's that we dehumanize the other side and we tend to paint them as our enemy. We're so quick to forget that the left wing and the right wing are both wings of the same bird, and we need them both to fly, right? Just because somebody votes differently, has a different idea politically, belongs to a different party, doesn't make them your enemy, doesn't make them evil, it doesn't make them full of hatred. It just means that they have a different idea of what's best for our country. And the beautiful thing about our country is everybody gets to have those ideas. We share them together. Hopefully we try to find some compromise. If we're going to turn things around in this country, we've got to remember that. We've got to stop dehumanizing each other. We've got to tamp down the rhetoric. We've got to stop painting the other side as our enemy. That definitely happened, no matter what side you stand on. That definitely clearly happened on January the 6th in a very combustible situation. And it's been happening from all sides for some time. So there's the inauguration. There's the impeachment. Let's talk about something else. Let's switch to this. Let's talk about the Trump pardons. Man, there was a lot of them, right? On his way out, just like many presidents do, Donald Trump issued over 100 pardons. I mean, Dude went Oprah Winfrey on him. He was like, you get a pardon, and you get a pardon. Who would like a pardon? Would you like a pardon? Eric, no, you don't get one. Who else? Pardons for everybody. Look under your chair. You get a pardon. Dude was just handing them out left and right. He gave pardons to rappers Lil Wayne and Kodak Black, to his buddy Steve Bannon. He even gave pardons to some folks that really deserved it, to a lot of people who, for minor offenses, had gotten long sentences, and it was they were jailed unfairly. He let them out. He commuted their sentences, or he gave them a full pardon, which was awesome. Lil Wayne, I just want to say, we see you, dog. Like, we see you. Back when those pictures surfaced online of Lil Wayne and Trump together, they had had a meeting. Lil Wayne was seeming to endorse Trump leading up to the election, and people were like, this is out of left field. What is this all about? Hey, now we understand. Little bit of a contract there, wasn't it? Lil Wayne was like, hey, man, I'll support you if you pardon me. And Donald Trump apparently was like, hey, all right. So I don't know if Lil Wayne should get more street cred for that or less street cred for that, but we see you. A little taken aback by the pardon of Kodak Black. I don't know how Donald Trump knows who Kodak Black is or what made him choose to pardon Kodak Black. I mean, if you're going to pardon somebody from the hip-hop world, you could have been more creative and more interesting, right? Like, you could have pardoned Asada Shakur, brought her home from Cuba. You could have pardoned Suge Knight if you want to make things real interesting. But he pardoned Kodak Black. He might have just thought that was a silly name and got excited. I don't know. But a lot of people got pardons. The one person that did not get a pardon, one Joseph Maldonado Passage. Man, Joe Exotic, you guys, we could have had season 2, season 3. That man would have been on Facebook Live every day. Dude had a limo parked outside of the jail all day long waiting on his phone call. Now, should I feel bad for this man? No, probably not, right? He did some despicable things. We all saw the Netflix documentary. Not the best guy. But I kind of wanted to see what it would be like for him to enter 2021, right? Like, I kind of wanted to see this man and his mullet and all of his glory walk out of that jail a free man and let, you know, 2020 was crazy. If we gonna get crazy, let's get crazy, you know? I was kind of hoping, like, what would Joe Exotic have to say about all this craziness? But alas, Carole Baskin wins again. Carole Baskin 2, Joe Exotic 0. And that's our political talk for today. Let's switch over to sports. We'll hit some headlines here, too. Conor McGregor returns to the octagon for UFC 257 versus Dustin Poirier from Fight Island tomorrow. I think McGregor wins there. Conor McGregor. That was so bad. The Texans continue to be a dumpster fire. No surprise there. Antonio Brown is out against the Packers, but Patrick Mahomes is cleared to play against Buffalo. Notre Dame has been placed on probation for recruiting violations. And Larry Scott's time as commissioner of the Pac-12 is coming to an end. And all the people say amen, right, Pac-12 fans? In the world of college football, with any offseason, you have the coaching carousel. So what we want to do when it comes to the world of college football right now is we want to issue our In the Shed coaching carousel grades. These are our evaluations and grades of some of the new coaches who have been hired by prominent schools, both in the SEC and otherwise. And the first one is the Texas Longhorns. The Texas Longhorns have added Alabama offensive coordinator Steve Sarkisian. He has head coach experience both at USC and at Washington. Sarkisian is one of the best offensive minds in the game. I mean, just take a look at what he's done with Alabama's offense. He took the torch from Lane Kiffin, and he ran with it. They had the most prolific offense I've ever seen this last year. All kinds of talent that he brought in. He's a great recruiter. You got to assume, even though a lot of times Nick Saban's coaching tree, the coaches haven't been so successful, you got to assume that Sarkisian has learned a little bit about organization from the master of organization. That's all about the process with Saban. And if Sarkisian can implement even a quarter of that, he'll have immense success at Texas. It'll be interesting to see what he does. He's already put together some staff from Alabama that he brought over with him. He just hired the defensive coordinator from Washington, who he was familiar with. So overall, we give this hiring a B+. I do think that Steve Sarkisian will have success at Texas. I'm not sure that he will rival Alabama or that he'll take the throne from Nick Saban, not say anything crazy like that, but we give it a B+. Now, over at my favorite university, over at Auburn, they let Gus Malzahn go. And a lot of Auburn fans were pretty excited about that. It's been an up and down thing. We've had four losses for year after year. We always seem to lose the big game. However, Gus Malzahn does own the best record against Nick Saban of any active head coach. I think he was 2-3 at Auburn against Saban, 2-4, something like that. He beat him a couple times, which is almost miraculous. I like Gus. I like him a lot. It probably was time for both of them to get a change, and wherever he goes, I'll root for him. But Auburn kind of came out of left field and hired Brian Harsin, who was the head coach at Boise State. His record at Boise State was 69-19. He's got a track record as a winner, but at Boise State, pretty much everybody that's been there for the last four or five head coaches have been winners, and he has no experience in the SEC. So it's going to be really interesting to see what he does. He's made some good hires to his staff. He hired Mike Bobo, that is a veteran offensive coordinator in the SEC. And he hired Derek Mason as defensive coordinator, the coach that just got fired from Vanderbilt. However, he was a defensive coordinator at Stanford previously to being hired at Vanderbilt and had a lot of success there. He retained Cadillac Williams, one of the best running backs ever to play at Auburn, as the running back coach. He brought in former Auburn player Zach Etheridge to coach the secondary, who was on Auburn's 2010 national championship team with Cam Newton and company. So he's made some good hires. I'm going to give this a B minus. I think Harsin has the motivation and the discipline to be successful at Auburn. I think he's put together a pretty good staff. It's really going to be a matter of recruiting. Right now, Auburn's in a tough spot. They've got like the 47th ranked recruiting class. They still have like 13 spots to fill. Because of the timing of the firing of Gus Malzahn right before the first of two signing days, they lost out on several recruits. They've had players declare for the draft and transfer. So really, the jury's out. We don't know what to expect there, but I'm going to give that a B minus for right now. In the Big Ten, Illinois has gotten rid of Lovie Smith, and they have hired Brett Bielema, who comes back to the Big Ten. He's coming to the Big Ten from the NFL, but before that, he was at Arkansas, and previous to Arkansas was head coach of Wisconsin. If you remember, at Wisconsin, he had a lot of success in the Big Ten. That did not translate well to the SEC at all. So when it comes to Brett Bielema, there's kind of a bad taste in the mouth when it comes to college football. But he has shown that he can be successful in the Big Ten before. I think that he'll raise the profile of Illinois. I think that he's a good program builder. I think that he'll have success there relative to Illinois. So we're going to give that a B. And then at South Carolina, they hired Shane Beamer, son of the legendary coach of Virginia Tech for so long, Frank Beamer. I think this is probably exciting for most South Carolina fans. Shane Beamer has been an assistant coach many different places, has a lot of experience in the SEC and in big-time college programs, but he's also very unproven as a head coach. He's never even been a coordinator. We don't really know what his staff is going to look like on the field. We don't know what type of recruiter he's going to be as a head coach. And honestly, South Carolina is just a very difficult place to win. It's a difficult place to recruit to with Clemson right there. The SEC East is not easy. There's a stranglehold on that side of the conference by Georgia and now Florida. And so he's got his work cut out for him. We're going to give that grade a C-plus for the moment. I'm interested to see what he does there. I think that he can be successful over time, but I am not sold at this time. Also, got to have to say, the most interesting hire does not go to Texas, does not go to Auburn, not Illinois, not South Carolina, or any other Power 5 school. The most interesting hire of all, Louisiana Monroe. Louisiana Monroe has hired Terry Bowden as their head football coach. Terry Bowden, who was at Auburn and left in a horrible situation years and years and years ago. Terry Bowden, who's 64 years old, who has been a graduate assistant with Dabo Swinney at Clemson. The last time he was a head coach was at Akron. He had a good year, maybe a couple of good years, but did not have much success there. And now he's got another shot here at Louisiana Monroe. And that's exciting to me that he gets another shot. It's going to be a lot of fun to see what he does, to see what he's learned, how he's adapted, and how he does as a head coach. So those are our football coaching carousel grades. Steve Sarkisian gets a B+. Brian Harsin a B-. Brett Bielema a B. Shane Beamer a C+. And the most interesting hire award goes to Terry Bowden and Louisiana Monroe. Switching to NCAA basketball, the top 10 currently looks like this. Gonzaga is ranked number 1 at 14-0, and Baylor is number 2 at 12-0, followed by Villanova at 3, Iowa at 4, Texas at 5, Tennessee at 6, Michigan at 7, Houston at 8, Kansas at 9, and Wisconsin rounding out the top 10. The talk right now seems to be about teams that are as advertised and teams that aren't. Gonzaga is as advertised. They've been ranked number one all year, and they're undefeated. And I'm hearing a lot of chatter on sports talk radio and on ESPN. Will Gonzaga finally win it all? Will this be the year that Mark Few finally gets a championship? They may have gotten one last year had the tournament actually happened. Of course, March Madness was upended like everything else due to COVID. Will this be the year that they win it all? And on top of that, will they go undefeated? Will they win the rest of their games? You know, they play in a conference that really they're the only competition. They're the only nationally prominent team. So will they win their conference and go undefeated? And then will they go undefeated throughout the tournament? And I'm going to say no. It's just too hard. It doesn't happen. It's rare. You remember several years back when Kentucky was absolutely loaded. They went into the tournament undefeated. It looked like it would be a cakewalk. And then they lost. So it's very possible that Gonzaga wins. They very well may win it all. They've got as good a chance as anybody. I don't think that if they win the regular season, or if they finish, rather, the regular season undefeated, that will continue in the tournament. I think probably the best thing for them is to drop one game, maybe two games in conference, and then to enter the tournament with one or two losses and go from there. So they might win it all. I don't think that they're going to go undefeated. And then the disappointing teams, man. Look at Kentucky. Look at Duke. Duke is still kind of hanging around close to the top 25, but not quite in there. Mike Krzyzewski, of course, has suggested that maybe they shouldn't be playing basketball at all this year with the pandemic. A lot of people are quick to say that he would not have that opinion if he were ranked in the top 10, and there may be some truth to that. And then you have Kentucky. Every year, John Calipari brings in a new host of top-rated recruits who are all freshmen, and he finds a way to put it all together. And so far this year, that's not happening. His freshmen don't quite look as athletic. Their jump shot has not yet conveyed to the college game. They're not playing good team defense. And they've just had a disappointing season. It's been a tough grind for them. I still think they'll put it together. They'll improve over the course of the year. But they really need a strong showing in SEC play and maybe even a deep run in the SEC tournament, if not winning the whole SEC tournament to make March Madness. And the problem is with the pandemic, there's worry and fear right now that conference tournaments may not even happen. So without a conference tournament, I'm not sure that the Wildcats really have a chance to make the NCAA tournament. And man, would that not be something if we played March Madness and we did not have Kentucky or Duke? It would make a lot of people very happy, but it would also be less interesting. So real quick, before we move on to the NBA, I want to give you three teams to watch moving forward this season in college basketball if you've just been giving cursory attention to the sport. Take a look at these three teams, watch them. They're on the rise, and I think that they're pretty underrated. The first of which is Houston. Houston is ranked in the top 10, so how do I call them underrated? Because they're ranked 8th, and I think that they're a top 5 basketball team. They play really good defense. They move the ball on offense. They're deep. They're competitive. They're scrappy. I think that Houston Cougars are a team to watch moving forward. Also, take a look at Alabama. They're ranked 18th, but they're one of the hottest teams in the country. This is coming from an Auburn fan. Nate Oates has done an incredible job building a program. They've got so much talent on that team. I mean, they're fast. They're tough. They play with toughness. They rebound really well. They have shooters. Nate Oates is a program builder. He's doing a superb job there at Alabama. They're ranked 18th, but I expect them to climb and climb. Right now, they're far and away the best team in the SEC, even better than Tennessee that's ranked in the top 10. So keep an eye on them. The other team that I'm going to pick for you to keep an eye on is one that's not ranked in the top 25, at least not yet, and that's Florida State Seminoles. Florida State has quietly become a basketball school. I mean, if you look at the last couple years here, their basketball program has been great. Leonard Hamilton is one of the most underrated coaches perennially in all of college basketball. He gets the job done. Those Seminoles know how to play defense. They know how to get turnovers, and they don't turn the ball over. They're a good basketball team with a lot of talent. I think those three teams are teams to watch: Houston, Alabama, Florida State. Remember that I said that. Come holler at me, March Madness. So moving on to the NBA, the thing that we have to talk about, that everybody's talking about when it comes to the NBA, and that's the Brooklyn Nets. The Brooklyn Nets, who already have Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, and now through trade have added James Harden. What a crazy story that this team would have James Harden, Kyrie Irving, and Kevin Durant on one team, right? I mean, Tillman Fertitta, the billionaire owner of the Rockets, I thought it was hilarious. He probably could have got a better deal from other teams. He probably could have got more pieces from other teams. There's reports that Daryl Morey, that used to work for him as the GM in Houston and now is with the 76ers, he was prepared to give up Ben Simmons in a package in order to get James Harden to Philly. And James Harden wanted to go to Philly. That was one of his preferred destinations. But Tillman Fertitta wasn't having it. Word is that he was so frustrated with Daryl Morey saying basically that he wanted to go be with his family and spend more time with family, but then taking a job with the 76ers that he just wouldn't even answer the phone and wouldn't deal with him. And so he trades him to Brooklyn. Now, a lot of people have made comments about those three guys on one team. They think that there's going to be cohesion issues, that they're going to have a hard time on the offensive side of things because, as the old adage goes, three dominant scorers and only one ball. Let's get real. That's not going to be a problem. It's not going to be an issue. If Kyrie Irving has an off night, you've got Kevin Durant, who's possibly the most dominant scorer in basketball today. I mean, nobody can block his jump shot. He can drive. He's pretty much 7 feet tall. He's a slender assassin. James Harden is a force of nature. He gets to the free throw line. And Kyrie Irving, other than Steph Curry, has the best handles in the game. They all can shoot from the outside. I mean, offensively, they're going to be fine. That's not a problem at all. The problem might be with their defense. Now, Kevin Durant has potential to be an all-world defensive player when he's engaged, when he's motivated to do so, when he's in the right culture. We've seen that in Golden State. Next to Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, he was an elite defensive player. I mean, there was a year there in Golden State where Kevin Durant should have won the NBA Defensive Player of the Year. I mean, he was that good on defense. So the problem is not with him, but Kyrie Irving and James Harden, are they even going to care? Are they going to pretend to play defense? And then the other issue is one of depth. I mean, coming into the season before that trade, the Brooklyn Nets were in such a position that they had three guys off the bench that would start for a lot of NBA teams. I mean, they had really built some depth because they took a team that was already a playoff team, and then they added Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving to the fold. But now they've traded away that depth. They don't have the same bench that they had. They got rid of some toughness, some athleticism, and some defense. So we'll have to keep an eye on Brooklyn. I think they're like fifth or sixth in the East right now. I expect for that to change, for them to improve. I'm not worried at all that they lost their first game with their new big three to the Cavaliers in overtime. I think double overtime. Colin Sexton was great in that game. That doesn't worry me at all. But they don't have the depth that they would have otherwise. And defense is going to be an issue when it comes to the playoffs. So we'll see. Maybe with those three guys, maybe they can just outscore everybody. I have a hard time believing they'll be able to do that if they face off against like Los Angeles or a team. Well, even the Clippers or the Lakers or somebody else that can match them talent for talent. So we'll keep an eye on that. Another thing I want to talk about is the Warriors. The Warriors, who were coming into this season, were poised to be an interesting team with Klay Thompson and Steph Curry, both returning from injury. And of course, Klay Thompson had that setback. He got hurt. He's out again for the entire season. I've been watching the Warriors play. Steph Curry's been balling. He had 62, a career high in one game. He had 35 against Jamal Murray. Just the other day, he had a big game when the Warriors beat the Lakers in Staples Center. He hit a go-ahead three late in the game right over Anthony Davis. It was pretty cool. The Warriors are an interesting team. They've got the rookie 19-year-old James Wiseman, who played three games at Memphis, and he's good. I mean, he's a really good player. He's got great instincts and soft hands. He's good around the basket. He's got a good jump shot, and he's really good off the dribble. But here's the thing I like about him the most. He's willing to play defense, and he's willing to be coached. The three or four games I've watched the Warriors play already this year, you see Draymond Green coaching him up, giving him directives, yelling at him, and James Wiseman is all ears. He's taking it. He's not taking offense. He's listening to critiques. He wants to get better. He wants to be a part of things. So this is going to be an interesting team to watch moving forward. I think they've won two out of the last three since Draymond has been back. They've started to put it together a little bit. Now, they're only a couple games above 500. They don't have a great record. They're like seventh in the West. I don't know where they'll finish. Maybe they'll be fifth. Maybe they'll be sixth. But they're the type of team that they can hang around. They've got the best shooter in the history of the game in Steph Curry. And they're not a team that you're going to want to play in the playoffs. And then you look at next year. If you have Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Andrew Wiggins, who's having a great year so far this year, Draymond at the four, and James Wiseman, And you have somebody like Eric Paschal coming off the bench, Kevon Looney, veterans Bazemore, Brad Wanamaker. I mean, that's a good team. Like, that's a solid team moving forward. So, you know, everybody's quick to dismiss the Warriors. Everybody's always hating on Steph Curry. Steph Curry, two-time MVP. Steph Curry, who's the greatest shooter of all time. He underperforms in the playoffs. He's not this. He's not that. Yeah, no. He's good. Like, he's legit good. Like, he makes his team better. He encourages his team to play the right way. When he's on the floor, they pass the ball more. He's unselfish. He's a good leader. He doesn't hang his head. I mean, Steph Curry is one of the five best basketball players alive. Don't ever forget it. So in the East right now, let's run through the playoff picture. I know it's early in the season, but it's never too early to look at the playoff picture. Philadelphia holds the top spot in the East at 10-5, with Boston second at 8-5, and Milwaukee right behind at 9-6. Then you have the Pacers, the Nets that we talked about, the New York Knickerbockers with Tom Thibodeau, the Cavs, and the 8th seed Atlanta Hawks. Keep an eye on the Hawks. They've got so much talent they added in the offseason so far. They've been a bit of a disappointment, but I expect them to come together. And hey, just for them to even be in the playoff picture at all right now is a huge, huge win for them early on in this season. The West playoff picture looks like this. The Lakers hold the top spot at 12-4, followed by Utah Jazz at 11-4. They've had a great start to the year. Then the Los Angeles Clippers are the current 3 seed, followed by the Suns. And I'll tell you what, I'm not a Chris Paul fan. Like, the dude just complains and complains and complains. He's one of the biggest three whiners in the entire league. But man, he makes teams better. Like, I feel like if you add Chris Paul to your team, that's like a good 15-win difference. I mean, seriously, look at the teams that he's been added to. Every single one gets better. Oklahoma City last year, what they did in the bubble and the run that they made, it was incredible. Mostly because they had Chris Paul on the floor. He just knows what he's doing. He knows how to make his team better. And he's doing that with the Suns. Then you have the Blazers, the Memphis Grizzlies, Golden State Warriors at 7th, and the San Antonio Spurs rounding out the playoff picture. Dallas and Denver, huge disappointment so far. Neither one of those teams are even in the playoff picture. You have a team like Memphis that's missed a lot of guys due to COVID, that's had to cancel games, postpone things. They're in the playoff picture. And you have teams like Dallas and Denver who are filled with talent, who have good rosters, who have good coaches. They're not even in the playoff picture so far. The points leaders, Bradley Beal is averaging an ungodly 34.9 points a game. Kevin Durant second in the league at 31.3 points. Steph Curry at 28.2. He's playing MVP-level ball. Damian Lillard, 28.1. He's always good. And the perennially underrated Zach LaVine is averaging 27.4 points a game for the Chicago Bulls and Billy Donovan. Moving on to the NFL. NFL playoffs are in full swing with just a couple games left to decide who plays in the Super Bowl. Now, coming into the playoffs, I played a game that I play a lot of times called Three Against the Field when it comes to the NFL playoffs. It's simple. It's where you take a look at all the teams in the playoffs and you pick three. And the bet is that your three teams will succeed over the field and will win the Super Bowl. You're supposed to pick three teams, one of them that you think will win at least. So I took the Bills, the Buccaneers, and the Seahawks. Obviously, Russell Wilson let me down, but the Bills and the Buccaneers are still going strong, and so I feel pretty good about that, and we'll see how that goes. On the coaching front, there's been a lot of change so far and already. Urban Meyer to the Jaguars, that's going to be fun to watch and interesting. I don't really know what to think about that. On the one hand, Urban Meyer is a winner. He's won everywhere he's been. He's a program builder. He'll have a chance to have Trevor Lawrence at quarterback and a couple of good pieces there in Jacksonville, but my questions remain about his health. I mean, doesn't he literally have a brain tumor that is made worse by the stress of coaching football, and his family has begged him repeatedly to stop coaching football? But here he is again, coaching football. I mean, that's kind of a crazy thing. Is his health going to hold on? And then also, can he adapt? The problem that you see a lot of times when college coaches step to the NFL is that they fail to realize there's a difference in how they approach their players. In the NFL, you can't treat everybody the same. You just can't. You can't treat your veteran quarterback who's a star in the league the same way that you treat the last guy on the bench. I know that's not a popular thing to say, but it's true. Also, the fact that these are grown men and not college students, you have to have more patience. You have to let them be a part of the process and the game planning a lot more than in college. You have to be less of a carnival barker. Can someone like Urban Meyer, who has won everywhere he's been, who's supremely confident, can he have the adaptability to make those changes in order to be successful? I don't know. We'll find out. The thing about Urban Meyer is he tends to flame out wherever he is. He coaches really hard for 2, 3, 4 years, and then he's gone. And it'll be interesting to see if that is what happens there in Jacksonville. Besides Jacksonville, other coaching news that we have so far for the NFL is the dumpster fire that is the Houston Texans. The Houston Texans, who continue to ignore the wishes of star quarterback Deshaun Watson. Today they interviewed Jim Caldwell, who at least would be a step in the right direction if hired. And they also interviewed former NFL quarterback Josh McCown, who, as far as I'm aware, has absolutely no coaching experience in the NFL. They appear to have very little interest in Chiefs offensive coordinator Eric Bieniemy, at least for the moment. Maybe they'll talk to him if and when the Chiefs season is over, if they lose before the Super Bowl. I would think that would be who they would hire, who they would be interested in. That's who Deshaun Watson has expressed interest in. He's obviously an offensive genius and guru, but so far they have not shown much interest, so that's kind of surprising. There's other news on the NFL coaching front, and then there's this. The Detroit Lions, who can compete with anybody when it comes to incompetence. And they decide to hire Dan the Man Campbell as their head coach and hold an introductory press conference. And this guy says this.
This team is going to take on the identity of this city, all right? And this city's been down, and it found a way to get up. All right, it's found a way to overcome adversity. All right, and so this team's going to be built on, we're going to kick you in the teeth. All right, and when you punch us back, we're going to smile at you. And when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off. All right, and we're going to stand up. And then it's going to take 2 more shots to knock us down. All right, and on the way up, we're going to take your other kneecap, and we're going to get up. And then it's going to take 3 shots to get us down. And when we do, we're going to take another honk out of you. Before long, we're going to be the last one standing.
Good Lord Almighty. What in the world just happened? What was that? Dan Campbell, what are you doing? We're going to get knocked down, and then we're going to bite your kneecap. And then you'll hit us twice, and we'll fall again. But we'll take out your other kneecap. And then with no kneecaps, you won't be able to stand because the knees are connected to the leg bone. And the leg bone's... Oh, my gosh. His introductory press conference. That's the guy that you just hired to lead your football team. And that's what he said? Earlier he said, I could give you some coach speak, but you don't want to hear that. Please give us some coach speak. What are you talking about taking hunks out of people? What are you... I mean, that was the craziest thing I've ever heard from a coach in an introductory press conference, and it sounded like he was about to cry. I mean, we've all had those times, right, where we say some stuff, and I'm sure it'll happen on this podcast because it is live, it is in my shed, I'm not editing it. We've all had those moments where we just get to talking and we kind of walk out onto a ledge where we don't know what to say next or how to get out of it, and we're just like, Dan Campbell. Dan the Man Campbell. We're going to take out some kneecaps. I mean, maybe he'll do a good job, but I just can't imagine Bill Belichick or any other successful head coach beginning things in that way. I thought that was too good not to share. That was pretty wild. All right, let's pick the playoff games for this week. So we got 2 games left, AFC, NFC Championship. The winners will play in the Super Bowl. Here we go. In the AFC, we have the Buffalo Bills at the Chiefs, defending Super Bowl champions. The Chiefs are 3-point favorites, but I'm going to go with an upset. Even though Patrick Mahomes is cleared to play, and I'm sure he'll play well, I think the Bills pull out an upset. The Chiefs have not covered the spread in quite a while. Several games they haven't covered the spread. Andy Reid's a great coach. But I really like what the Bills do. I like what they do at quarterback. I like what they do on defense. I like their coaching staff. And I think that they win. I'm going to go with the Bills and the points. Bills 31, Chiefs 27 there. In the NFC, the Buccaneers at the Packers. You already know where I stand on this. One of my predictions for 2021 was Tom Brady wins the Super Bowl and retires. So I have kind of painted myself into a corner there. Let me say that I would not at all be surprised if the Packers won. They will be playing on the frozen tundra in Green Bay. They do have Aaron Rodgers, who's playing MVP level. They're having a great season. They've got a good team. They're tough. They run the football. I wouldn't be surprised if the Packers win, but I'm going to go with the Bucs. Buccaneers 23, Packers 17. I think that Tom Brady has enough weapons. The Buccaneers pick off Aaron Rodgers twice. They win. And we have the Buccaneers and Tom Brady against the Buffalo Bills for the Super Bowl. Moving on from the world of sports into the world of the paranormal. Now, what we'll do when we get to the world of the paranormal each week is I'll share some news stories that I have found with you and let you decide what to think about them. And then hopefully, eventually, you'll be able to share some of your experiences with us, and we might even read them on air. So the first news story of our show today comes to us from Chile. The headline says, "Doctor who died for 30 minutes after horrific accident describes near-death experience." A doctor who almost died relived the moment she believed she was led towards the heavens by spirits in a new Netflix series. Surviving Death looks at the survivors of near-death experiences, looking into what happens to people when they die for a short time before being brought back to life. There are also episodes on reincarnation and paranormal phenomena. Dr. Mary Neal from New York spoke about when she was trapped underwater for almost half an hour during a 1999 kayak accident in Chile. Neal, who's now 62, was pinned underneath her kayak and submerged for 24 minutes, her brain starved of oxygen the whole time. The mom of four told the son, "I was not breathing. My torso was absolutely plastered to the front deck of the boat, and I could feel my bones breaking. I thought I should be screaming, but I wasn't. I felt no pain, no fear, no panic. I felt more alive than I've ever felt. I could feel my spirit peeling away from my body, and my spirit went up towards the heavens. I was immediately greeted by a group of somethings. I don't know what to call them. People? Spirits? Beings? I didn't recognize any of them, but they had been important in my life somehow, like a grandparent who died before I was born. They were so overjoyed to welcome me and greet me and love me." She said the beings led her down a path covered with hundreds of thousands of flowers, which were every color of the universe. Neal described the experience as a shift in time and dimension. She said, "I experienced all of eternity in every second. Every second expanded into all of eternity. The pathway went to this great dome structure, and I believe I was in heaven. I had an overwhelming sense of being home." Her group spent 15 minutes trying to rescue her before switching into body recovery mode. She explained, "One of the guys saw my life jacket pop up downstream and thought that maybe my husband would want it. As he got there, he felt my body touch his leg and was able to reach under the water and grab my wrist. Miraculously, Neil didn't suffer any long-term damage to her brain. My body was bloated and purple and I had fixed eyes. There's no doubt in my mind that I was physically dead. But I watched from the entrance to the dome structure as they repeatedly did CPR, and I could still hear them." She remembers seeing the kayakers try to save her. She added, "I had been without oxygen for 30 minutes, and the statistical likelihood of my survival would have been next to zero. I did not want to go back down to my body. I had a very physical sensation of being held and comforted and reassured that everything was fine, but the beings told me that it wasn't my time, that I had more work to do on Earth, and that I had to go back to my body. When I opened my eyes, the guys who resuscitated me were stunned. Surviving Death is available to stream now on Netflix." Whoa. That's crazy. Imagine being dead for 30 minutes, everyone around you thinking that you were gone, and then you just pop back up like nothing happened. That is wild. Heaven as a dome and flowers, a road of flowers to get there. Interesting. Our next story comes to us from Harvard. A Harvard astronomer is more confident than ever that an alien probe visited us in 2017. Ooh. Abraham Lieb led Harvard's astronomy department for longer than anyone in history, from 2011 to 2020. And now he's doubling down on what could easily be his most important and controversial hypothesis from that period. Lee believes that... Well, how do you say that? Uma Uma. I'm going to go with Uma Uma. Lee believes that Oumuamua, an oddly shaped object that briefly visited our solar system in 2017, was most likely an alien probe. You probably saw the artist's illustrations of Oumuamua as a cigar-shaped asteroid. Its shape and movements, it seemed to speed up as it left our neighborhood, but without any discernible trail of gases like we might expect from a comet, baffled scientists and led Lieb to a far-out conclusion. I submit that the simplest explanation for these peculiarities in that object was created by an intelligent civilization not of this Earth, he writes in the introduction of his upcoming book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth. The book is set to be published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt on January 26th. It also lays out the potential implications of Lieb's conclusion for science, religion, and the future of humanity. Despite Lieb's long career in astrophysics, astronomy, and cosmology, that includes a long record of publications on heady topics like the nature of black holes and the development of galaxies, his ideas about Oumuamua have been controversial among scientists to say the least. Oumuamua was the first interstellar object to be seen passing through our solar system, and it was a big science story in the last few months of 2017, but it wasn't until last year that the spotting of that strange space something finally went full-on mainstream viral. That's when Lieb and postdoctoral researcher Shmuel Biley published a paper first suggesting that Oumuamua may be a fully operational probe sent intentionally to Earth by an alien civilization. Since then, Lieb has garnered worldwide media attention while others in the science community have been critical of his potentially revolutionary conclusion. It's a shocking example of sensationalist, ill-motivated science, fellow Forbes contributor and astrophysicist Ethan Siegel wrote in 2018. In the new book, Lieb addresses some of the criticism. To be clear, although I made myself as available as my commitments allowed, I neither sought the limelight nor particularly enjoyed it. He also accuses some of his critics of a sort of overly conservative groupthink when it comes to considering more exotic explanations for the anomaly that is Oumuamua. Lieb argues that such an unprecedented object as Oumuamua requires that scientists go wherever the evidence might lead. One inference is agreed to by everyone who has studied the data. This visitor, when compared to every other object the astronomers have ever studied, was exotic, Lieb writes. And the hypothesis offered up to account for all of the object's observed peculiarities are likewise exotic. So that's from a Harvard professor with years of experience who is literally telling us that in 2017 we were visited by an alien craft. That's pretty amazing. It's not no crackpot. See, I got Southern real quick. It's not no crackpot. It's not somebody that's just in the trailer park with three teeth talking about some, yeah, I've seen them lights, them red, them orange lights up in the sky. This is from a Harvard. This is from a well-to-do, well-studied, well-trained Harvard physicist who says that in 2017 we were visited by a craft made by aliens. Truly interesting stuff right there. That's really interesting. Kind of freaky, actually, reading a story like that, sitting out here in my shed in pitch black nighttime. But I'll be all right. I'm going to be all right, Kendrick. Our next story comes to us from Australia. The headline reads, creepy figure in Brisbane hospital air vent frightens patient and confuses the internet. Isn't the internet always confused? Question for another episode. A photograph of a mysterious figure in a Brisbane hospital air vent has confused the internet with many questions of if it's a ghost. A woman shared images to a Facebook group on the weekend, which her mother-in-law had taken of a creepy shadow in an air vent above her hospital bed. One photo is from a distance which shows a shadowy figure in the corner of the vent. A second picture is zoomed in, which shows what looks like eyes peering out of the vent. She shared them with a caption explaining that her family member felt as if something was looking at her and kept thinking nurses were coming into the room. It would blink and move and look around the room. Sometimes it was there, other times it wasn't, she wrote. She could feel something looking at her, keeping an eye on her. She would think the nurses were coming around to check her as she could feel people touching her, waking her up. But no one was there. Members of the Australian paranormal group agreed that the images were terrifying. No, looks like fingers, one person wrote. Another said, I hate hospitals. This is why I won't go there. People pass away. No way you will see me there. For real, that's what she said. A third person agreed it could have been a paranormal experience in reply to someone suggesting it might just be the insulation. The woman thought it was nurses waking her up. She could feel someone touch her. Insulation doesn't come and go. So very interesting because hospitals are full of spirits, the person commented. While another offered the idea that it could be a possum. Definitely. I've had one peer at me from air vents. A second person agreed. Man, for real though. Australia is like the international Alabama. Like people in Australia, I feel like they appreciate a good mullet. I feel like they all carry knives. The only difference is they live in a country where everything is trying to kill you. In Alabama, we just got the snakes and, you know, a few of them backwoods folks too. But yeah, man, Australia crazy. That person said it could be an opossum. I have seen one in an air vent previously. That's pretty funny. I'm looking at the picture right now. I got to tell you, it is kind of creepy. You have what looks to be eyes. It looks to me like eyes. I see them. I encourage you to look this story up online. See what you think. Let me know. Send us an email. It is kind of a creepy picture. I can see where it could be faked. This is a picture that could be faked. But as far as what she actually saw and what she believed she saw, the interesting thing is that the eyes moved and seemed to follow her around the room, indicating that there in fact was something there and it wasn't just a light trick or, you know, something that wasn't real. So, yeah, something in the air vent in a hospital in Australia, and it could be an opossum. It could be a leprechaun that got up in a tree. Y'all know that one? That's my Alabama stuff right there. Our next story comes to us from Keystone, South Dakota. Some from Brisbane, Australia. We go from Harvard to Brisbane, Australia, and now to Keystone, South Dakota. Keystone's Bigfoot Bash, a day of celebration and record-breaking. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, or Skunk Ape, whatever you call him, or her, it is 2021 after all. Popularity has skyrocketed, and Keystone residents were more than happy to welcome the creature of many names to town this weekend. The Keystone Chamber of Commerce and the Doll Chainsaw Art joined together for a Bigfoot Bash to measure the world's largest Bigfoot sculpture. Jarrett Dahl began working on it in October, and with the help of a crew from Kentucky, of course they were from Kentucky, was able to complete his art in roughly 8 days. The statue is made from Black Hills ponderosa pine, cedar, and cottonwood, and a side note, it would probably make a really great bonfire. A few years ago, I got the idea from a local guy to carve a much smaller Bigfoot. I'm sorry, that's a really funny sentence. This man said a few years ago, I got the idea from a local guy to carve a much smaller Bigfoot. He got an idea from a local guy. Hey, man, why don't you carve a real small Bigfoot, like, you know, like a Bigfoot or one of them Sasquatches, like a big one but smaller. And he was like, yeah. So anyway, a few years ago, I got the idea from a local guy to carve a much smaller Bigfoot. I've had a really good response. It's actually been probably one of the most popular pieces here. So that's kind of where the idea originated, I guess, said Jarrett Dahl, owner of Dahl Chainsaw Art. The Keystone Chamber used Bigfoot as an opportunity to display all the city has to offer. What are those things, Keystone, South Dakota? If you're in Keystone, South Dakota, let me know. I've never been to the beautiful state of South Dakota. What are all of the things that you have to offer? Whatever they are, the Chamber of Commerce has put them on display. With the addition of the Yeti, the city now has the largest wooden Bigfoot sculpture in the world. What a claim. So today we did the measuring, and he's exactly 22.8 feet tall from sitting on his butt to the top of his head. He should be the world's largest wooden chainsaw sculpture of Bigfoot. Man, that is specific. The world's largest wooden chainsaw sculpture of a Bigfoot, added Robin Pladson with the Keystone Chamber of Commerce. Getting in on the craze, shops in Keystone carried a variety of Bigfoot paraphernalia. What is Bigfoot paraphernalia? What does that mean? What does that mean? I'm having fun with this. I know t-shirts. Outside of that, like what is Bigfoot paraphernalia? I don't know. And the chamber is hoping to host more Bigfoot events in the future, which I guess if they have more of them, they will be Big Feet events, because feet is the plural of foot. I have an Alabama education, but that I know for certain. I tell you what, I've never been to South Dakota, but Keystone, I would love to join you next year for the Bigfoot Bash. And I'm going to say it right now, I invite my entire shed to the city of Keystone, South Dakota. So Keystone, if by chance somehow you are one of the seven people listening to this, Chamber of Commerce, if you would like to have In the Shed with Wes Anderson come out to the Bigfoot Bash and do a live podcast, you know, I'll help push some of that paraphernalia on my listeners. Meemaw will buy a t-shirt. You know, one of my brother-in-laws. We'll get this thing going. So Keystone, you let me know. Our last news story, and possibly the best or the worst, depending on your position, comes to us from Microsoft. Yes, that Microsoft. I got to tell you, this one is a little frightening, a little scary, a little spooky to me. And this is what the article says. Microsoft has patented a chatbot that could imitate a deceased loved one, celebrity, or fictional character. Microsoft has been issued a sci-fi sounding patent for a chatbot that could take on another person's personality and likeness. No thank you. Like, for real though. Like, I don't remember. I've never been on Tinder, but whichever way you swipe for things not to happen, like, that's the way I'm swiping as hard as it goes, full send. Like, I don't want nothing to do with that. I have instructed my beautiful wife, if I ever were to pass away, before she sheds a tear, before she contacts loved ones, before she calls the paramedics, the first thing I want her to do is deactivate my Facebook. Like, for real, like, log me out. Like, I don't want nobody commenting on the 3 years on the anniversary of my death. Like, I miss you so much. No, 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 no. According to documents from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the chatbot would be created through information that could easily be gathered on social media. Images, voice data, behavioral information, social media posts, and text messages. It could even take on a physical presence. The documents show, which would include plans for 2- and 3-dimensional recreations of people gathered through photos and videos of the individual. We have jumped the shark. This is the most stressful thing that I have heard all day long. While Microsoft's patent does not specifically say that the product would be used to bring deceased people back to life digitally, the plan does use dead loved ones as an example of how the chatbot could be implemented to recreate and imitate individuals from the real world. I'm sorry, but if your product uses dead loved ones as an example, don't make that product. Don't make that. Like, the plan uses dead loved ones as an example of how the chatbot could be implemented to recreate and imitate individuals from the real world. Whew, 2021. 2020 was wild. 2021 is like, hold my beer. The specific person may correspond to a past or present entity or a version thereof, such as a friend, a relative, an acquaintance, a celebrity, a fictional character, a historical figure, a random entity, etc., the patent reads. After the news of Microsoft's patent hit social media, this ought to be good, users compared it to an episode from Black Mirror called Be Right Back, which follows a character bringing a loved one back from the dead after a car crash using technology similar to that described in the patent. Like most Black Mirror episodes, the story takes a dark past when the character realizes the AI representation does not truly bring her deceased loved one back to her. Yeah, no joke people compared it to that episode of Black Mirror, because that's exactly what happened on that episode of Black Mirror. And it was a disaster, and it was terrifying, and it was horrifying, and it was a bad idea, and it's not something that we should ever do or consider. Why are you patenting this, Microsoft? My computer right now is a Microsoft computer. I'm so stressed out. I'm so stressed out. The patent was filed in 2017, the same year that aliens visited Earth, according to Harvard physicist. The patent was filed in 2017 but approved in December, because that's how long it takes for bad ideas to be approved by the patent office, apparently. It doesn't say that. That's just my ad lib. Tim O'Brien, general manager of AI programs at Microsoft, responded to some of the concerned tweets about the patent online, saying he's looking into the patent, though he's not aware of any plans to actually build or ship it. I'm calling BS on that. He's looking into the patent? Bro, you work there. You're the manager of AI programs. Did the AI apply for the patent without your permission? Breaking news, is that what's happening? Scary stuff. Scary stuff. The use of another person's likeness or personality could also cause some interesting legal battles if implemented. In most states in the U.S., an individual can be sued for using another person's likeness, name, or personal attributes for an exploitative purpose, without permission from the individual, according to Digital Media Law Project. Even the use of a deceased individual's likeness could cause legal troubles. 23 states in the U.S. recognize post-mortem rights, which allow a deceased person anywhere from 10 to 100 years of protection from unauthorized use of their identity, including name, voice, image, and likeness, from being used for profit. I'm sure Microsoft was planning to do it for free. It's not uncommon for a person's likeness to be used without their consent. For example, an individual can legally be photographed in public without their consent. Similarly, many celebrities in Hollywood have continued to be represented in media without their consent even after their death, with celebrities like Michael Jackson and Elvis Presley continuing to generate millions of dollars decades after their deaths. In 2019, one production company brought James Dean back digitally, using existing footage and photos to recreate the actor through CGI for the war film Finding Jack. I saved that one for last. And I instantly regret it. Like, I should have read that one first. I'm sorry for you, the listener, all seven of you, Meemaw, I'm sorry. That was tragic. That's scary. See, I don't read these ahead of time. I like to react live, just like everything else that we're doing here. No edits. This is all real stuff. And that is something I'm going to be thinking about when I'm trying to fall asleep. I do not want anyone in my family, any celebrity or anyone that I know that passes away to be recreated physically or digitally. It's creepy to me. That's a no for me, dog. Whew. Man, how do we recover from that? What an ending note. That's it. That's all for this week. It's over. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here, and neither can I. It's back in the house and out of the shed for me. Thanks again for listening to episode 001. Make sure to subscribe, like, share, and review. It really helps. If you have any paranormal experiences, opinions about sports or politics that you'd like to share with us, you can email us at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Again, that's intheshedwithwes, all one word, no spaces, @gmail.com. And if you use spell check and punctuation, I might even read it on air. So tune in again next week when we'll hit the headlines. We'll talk a little bit about Lizzie Borden. And I'll share with you about the scariest thing that I've ever witnessed. This has been In the Shed with Wes Anderson, the best news show in the land covering politics, sports, and the paranormal. Have an adventurous and fulfilling weekend. I'll catch you tools later. Peace out, Boy Scout.